Blog Talk Radio.
And tonight we present a discussion on the re-release of our science fiction epic film Beyond Lemuria in the second edition, which is presently available on Amazon in DVD. And our guest tonight will have Beyond Lemuria's director, Gregory Jednak, who also plays the villain Zoltan Nodescu in the film, and Ed Fitch, who has the dual role of Colonel Rich and Reverend Bobby John. Our main topic will be the new format with our Darrow Princess on the cover, and our new booklet that explains the Shaver mystery aspects of the film. Now, this is an important addition to help viewers understand the complex and esoteric meaning of the film. Our intergravitron machine opens a vortex between dimensions that is very similar to one described in a novel by Richard Shaver. He postulates an endless multiverse of dimensions he calls the simultane, which is complete, and this in three episodes of three different magazines forming one novel, which we are quoting in the booklet. Now, the simultane concept is compatible with ancient Hermetic philosophy and the latest theories of quantum physics, and that was back in 1949 when Shaver wrote that. Now, that we live different lives in different nows, both by choice and by accident, is our occult interpretation of the Shaver mystery and the key concept in Beyond Lemuria. So, tune in and find out what lies beyond the vortex. Well, we first released Beyond Lemuria in 2007. It took us about 2 years to make it. And I'd like to explain a little bit about what it is and why it took that long to make it and what we were intending to do with it when we did. What we wanted to do was make a film that was different, an occult film, different than anything that had ever been made before. And we wanted to use the natural resources that we had here in California to make the most of them. And we have here in California a magnificent, very, very impressive, not-so-dormant volcano. Some people like to think it's dormant, but it's not. This is Mount Shasta up in Northern California, and Mount Shasta has a marvelous, intriguing, and mysterious reputation as a holy mountain, where you can meet, if you're fortunate, and communicate with Atlantean and Lemurian adepts. And this has quite a history of this sort of thing, and we knew about this, and of course we thought that Mount Shasta, which certainly ought to be worked into an occult film made here in California by Californian occultists, we certainly should feature Mount Shasta. So we knew we needed to do that. But then we decided that in making this film, if it's going to be dramatic and it's going to be present a spectrum of occultism, you know, from the light side and the dark side, want to have a drama, well, what's our villainous side of this thing going to be? What's the dark side of this film going to be? Where are we going to get the drama? Well, that fell into two categories. Dead Bitch, who's going to call in tonight, is an ardent spelunker, and so was I, but some time back. But Dead came from that area. He was brought up in that Mount Shasta area. He was raised up there. And Ed is, along with myself, we're both fans of Richard Shaver's Fantastic Shaver Mystery back in when we were teenagers. And Shaver had postulated an underground network of mutated, sinister creatures that lived in caverns under the earth and had in their possession ancient ray machines left over from the days of Atlantis and Lemuria that they used to control people on the surface with the telepathic mind control. Well, anyway, they were underground people, troglodytes, and it turns out that Ed knew about some very, very interesting, sinister cave network right under Mount Shasta. Well, we didn't want to do anything evil up on Mount Shasta because it has a beautiful reputation for light workers and beautiful. You wouldn't want to do anything on the slopes of Mount Shasta that would be anyway evil. So, obviously, the evil in our film, the bad guys, would have a perfect venue in these lava caves in the Badlands right north of Mount Shasta. There's this network of lava caves, and they're very sinister. And in fact, the biggest one is called Pluto's Cave, and it has a sort of a ferocious reputation. The Indians, back before the white man came, the Indians believed that the cave was haunted by giants who squeezed their victims to death. And so this is perfect for our Darrows, for Shaver's Darrows to be down in these lava caves, which are essentially under the mountain because they are the lava flow from the mountain and the tubes in the lava flow. So we had, with this idea in mind, we had a perfect, we thought, a perfect comparison between light and darkness and spirituality on the mountain and deviltry under the mountain. And we had the makings of a really, really very interesting and exciting movie. Okay, we got a call. Who am I speaking with?
This is Greg.
Oh, hi, Greg. Okay, I just started introducing this thing. I think you probably heard what I've been saying so far.
Yes, I have.
And I was just getting to the point where I was explaining how we decided to use Mount Shasta and the caves, Pluto's Cave, and work a story around it where we would have the good guys going up the mountain to receive enlightenment and the bad guys going down in the caves to get power. And so and the idea then from there, that then we thought, okay, why not have one set of actors playing their opposite counterparts and then cut back and forth between the two. And this was this gave us sort of a medieval morality play kind of framework. And so
right.
with that idea
right.
in mind, I did the screenplay, and some of it, of course, I had to do on the spot because we had to make it work. We had to make it work with what we had. But so I set the scene pretty much for what we were going to do.
Right.
And why don't you go and tell us a little bit about how it was making this film?
Okay. Well, making the film was really, first of all, a lot of fun, and secondly, it was somewhat difficult because it was a perfect location. We had the Pluto's Caverns, and we had Mount Shasta, so we had everything location-wise all there. But as you recall, we had some location problems, and remember the fire that we had that was raging up above, and we all had to get out from under the ground and get our cars out. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember it. It was a forest fire raging right toward our cars parked out behind the cave, and Ed was the line producer, by the way, for Shasta because he grew up around there. He was back at one of the skylights, and we were back in one of the galleries inside the cave. We were all set up, and Ed got on the radio to us and said, "Hey, there's a forest fire heading right toward the cars. We gotta grab everything and get out." And
yep.
you know, I remember we struck the set and got out of there record time. But what that ended up doing was it ended up throwing us a day off schedule. And
true. You're
so,
very true.
So go ahead. Now, you remember how Mitch solved the problem, you know, where we shot. We had to shoot. Mitch said, okay, we don't have time, so we're going to have to shoot everything in one way, everything one way, because we only had using one camera at that point. And we had to shoot everything
right.
one way in the cave, and then we were going to have to build a cave to match it back in Los Angeles in order to shoot the other way.
Right,
that?
And that was really interesting because Mitch and I both, we got our principal photography, which was our big cave shots initially, so it gave us the grandeur of Pluto's Cavern when they're walking into it, and then Mitch shot some tight shots that were, you know, brilliantly shot, and then when it came time to, oh, my gosh, we don't have time to do this anymore down in the real caverns, you and I went out and got the set and put them into a place in, what was it, Alhambra? Not Alhambra.
Anaheim.
But,
no, it was Anaheim.
Anaheim.
Yeah, and, we rented an old match.
No, they matched perfectly, Poke. They matched perfectly, Poke. And it's amazing.
Absolutely.
Because I just watched the movie recently, you know, knowing that I was going to be on the Hermetic Hour with you, and that you can't tell the difference whether it's real cave or Anaheim cave. I mean, you can't tell. You just can't tell.
Well, absolutely.
But,
in fact, that is, I've challenged people to look at that whole sequence and see whether they can identify what is the cave that we built inside that cabinet shop in Anaheim and the one that we shot up at Pluto, because we cut back and forth. But they can't. Nobody.
Right. Yeah, we did.
Not even the professionals. They can't tell the difference.
No, it's very true. Because, you know, really, you and I picked up exactly the right backdrops, you know, rolling sets, rock sets, that matched what we had shot in Shasta initially. Or Pluto's Cave, I mean. But, you know, true, amazing. Amazing. It really worked. And even the mural, do you remember that you created a mural at one point that we could use for a backdrop? Do you remember that?
Yeah, well, we had to do, to do Merrick going through the vortex. Remember, that
correct.
Was almost a... That was almost a post, almost a post-production thing. We had to have a shot of Merrick going through the vortex and being sucked into the other dimension. And
right.
of course, I got to explain now, you know, we one of the things that we are emphasizing in this film and that we are trying to explain to people in this booklet that we have in that accompanies the second edition is that in our concept of Shaver's mystery, these caves are actually in a dimension, in a parallel world, very, very close to our own. And now Shaver, when he first had the visions of this cavern world, that was back in, it was before World War II, actually, but he had these visions. And
1949.
That was the one that we're quoting is 1949, but actually it was 1938 when he was having these original visions, and there was
in
those days, the whole parallel world idea of parallel worlds was just a literary device. It wasn't there was no scientific validity to it. So Shaver was bound and determined that that these visions that he were having, he thought they were absolutely real in this dimension. Well, of course, we know they weren't. But then finally, he conceived, and I don't think he ever admitted it, except he kind of did in the foreword to this this novel that we're quoting in the booklet. That you'd create a wormhole through all these other dimensions that were right laying alongside you, and that you could walk into these other worlds, and that they were just as real as the one you just walked out of.
No, that's correct. And I got to tell you something. After reading a lot of Shaver, doing our pre-production, you and I, both of us, we were reading everything. Well, you already read it, but I was picking up on it. We're very true to what he actually thought was true. I mean, we were very consistent. When Abaddon, the character Abaddon, goes into the vortex, all we didn't show was all the windowed worlds on either side. That was an energy tube that he walked through to find Dr. Nodescu. And it was very true to Shaver's initial thinking, what he really thought.
Vortex, that vortex that Doug Carey created.
Correct.
We bought his vortex. And we've since used
it.
We
well.
We since used it for the pathworking video.
Let's just use a laser beam. That works.
Laser beam and mirrors. And he created this and smoke. And he created this wonderful vortex effect.
It was brilliant.
Yeah.
It was brilliant.
Yeah.
Doug, you, Poke. Now, come on. Let's put some credit where it's due. Poke, you creating the intragravitron machine itself and the torture device that we use near the end of the film to kill our character, Miss Lilith, is brilliant. I mean, if it wasn't for you two guys working together on the special effect, it never would have come across as cool, in my opinion, as it did.
Well, this brings up a point. Now on the cover, when we originally released the film in 2007, we had Frater Solomon, who plays Vyaza, the fallen angel, and we had him on coming up over the top of Mount Shasta, and he has three eyes and horns and looks like a sort of a halfway between an angel and a devil, and with these three eyes each. And we had one of the Hubble telescope vortexes behind him, so it's a very nice cover, and it's very good. But this time we have the Darrow princess, we have the Darrow princess up behind that sinister ancient ray machine, and which I designed and Doug built. Oh, that thing! You can see. You can see Isabel up there with her eyes rolled up in her head, and she's playing this color organ and killing poor Lilith.
Here's a good aside for your audience, folks. That day that we shot that, two things happened that were bad. One was that Isabel was late, which was not unusual. And we used to remember how we had another girl just do the back of her head.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't want to get into that for various reasons. But I agree with you.
Yeah, I agree with you.
However, let me say this about Isabel. Somebody had taken Isabel out for dinner the night before and to a sushi place, and she got some bad sushi.
Oh, that's right.
Eating.
Yes, that's right.
That's easy to do. And
I remember that
was,
now.
She was really ill, and she was late,
that's
of course,
true.
Because she was ill, and she was so ill she could hardly walk when she came in, and she was a trooper. She got up there and did that scene. And just absolutely great. She was terrific.
No, she was brilliant. But do you know the other thing that happened that same day?
What?
She forgot her Darrow contact lenses.
Yeah,
and
had
I
to
lent
use yours.
Her mine. She had to use mine.
Well, you see her on the cover. When you see her on the cover, she's got those lenses on, and
yep.
It looks like her eyes are just nothing but white. They're just white. White, the whites of her eyes
well,
is all you can
glowing.
See.
They're glowing.
She looks,
you know?
she looks like the insane, sadistic Darrow princess. But the machine itself, this is one of the best. Well, of course, aside from that Japanese thing, which isn't very good, we've got the only Shaver mystery film, in existence. And so I can't say, I could say, well, this is the best ancient Shaver machinery ever done, because it's the only Shaver machinery ever done. But boy, we really outdid ourselves between myself and Doug Carey and Isabel, of course, to create this ancient gray machine that was built back in the days of Atlantis, and this thing's like a color organ. And it's got the evil side with the red lights and the good side with the blue lights. And Mitch lit this thing beautifully, and then the laser. We had a ferocious laser. I think that laser we have no longer they don't sell those anymore. That thing's too powerful. And
you didn't want to get it flashed in your eyes. That's for sure.
No.
You didn't want that.
We locked that thing down tight because we didn't want anybody to get it in the eye with that one. So the ray machine was, I remember Doug was talking about us using Edsel parts and Studebaker parts for the ray machine, and I explained that we weren't using actually those parts. We were using the design elements because we wanted this thing to look very old. So we used old 1950s car styling to make it look 25 years old.
It's supposed to be elder tech. I mean, all of this is elder tech. It's technology. Really, remember now, as you have in the booklet, the new booklet that comes with the re-release, this is elder tech. This is before mankind became a kind of man, if you know what I'm saying.
Right.
So we were the underlings. We were the underlings of the gods.
Greg, that brings up a point, because we're getting ahead of ourselves here. And let me read what we have on the back page of the booklet so people can understand this a little better. And it says, what was the Shaver mystery? One of the 20th century's great hoaxes, or a madman's vision of another reality dangerously close to our own? In the years following World War II, science fiction writer Richard S. Shaver and his editor Raymond A. Palmer published a series of novels and stories in Amazing Stories and Fantastic Adventures, two popular pulp magazines that Palmer edited. And these tales were certainly amazing and fantastic, but Shaver and Palmer both claimed that they were based on long-suppressed truth. We were all victims of a vast conspiracy to hide the real history of planet Earth and the human race. the Shaver mystery revealed that humans were the underclass of a race of godlike beings from outer space who colonized the Earth over 20,000 years ago. When the sun began to emit dangerous radiation, the elder gods left the planet to find a new home in the reaches of space. And some of these extraterrestrials and most of their human slaves remained behind, seeking refuge from the sun's poisonous rays in a vast network of caverns, while others, our ancestors, remained stranded on the surface. When human history began, the still-inhabited underworld was known only in myth and legend, but its inhabitants were all down there, and many of the subterranean dwellers had degenerated into demonic creatures called Darrows, while a lesser number of Taros maintained their sanity. These underground people had access to ancient super-scientific ray machines that could make telepathic contact with unsuspecting surface people. In this way, the subterraneans kept their world secret by clouding the minds of all and tormenting those who discovered them. Beware, if you know about the Darrows, they know about you. Richard S. Shaver claimed that the cavern world of the Darrows was a physical reality. He claimed to have spent years in this underground nightmare world. He warned his readers of the danger from the caves, but his true story, recounting his own entrance to the cave world, was dreamlike. Shaver's editor, Ray Palmer, tried to convince Shaver that his caverns were an occult astral plane. Shaver had a different explanation that he concealed in his fiction. The caves were one of many parallel worlds of a multiverse he called the Simultane, worlds dangerously close and totally real. And now, for the first time, from Richard Shaver's own lost writings, we reveal the secret entrance to the cavern world. Oh, boy.
It's good stuff. The new booklet really fills a gap, folks. It does. Fills a gap for the viewer to get a better grasp of the material. And it's something that was needed to be done, and it makes the second edition far more accessible to someone who doesn't have full understanding of what the Shaver mysteries are about, or Shaver mystery is about. You know?
Absolutely.
But if I may accent this, I would like to, in the words of Zoltan Nodescu regarding the Gravitron, and this is what he says. This is the words that you gave me to say on the movie, and they were great. And I don't even know how I got through them, quite honestly, as I watched the film again. But I'll try to do it one more time. Just a little piece of it, Tom. It's an interdimensional gravity wave accelerator. Gravity is the only force that passes between dimensions. Therefore, when we find convergence points between the cave of our world and the caverns of the subterranean world, we can establish contact. We can even open a vortex through which could be explorers into space. There you go. But that's really the deal, isn't it? I mean,
we're doing. Yeah, that's it. That's perfectly perfect description of it. And yet Shaver, when he came up with this idea, which we reprint in the booklet. We reprint the section from Shaver's novel.
Right.
We reprint that whole section in which they're using the machine, very similar to our intergravitron, to create this vortex, very similar to the one we're showing. And they walk through it, and they see the simultane through the walls of it, and then finally step out into another dimension, and we reprint that section.
Something that's important that I think you should mention. I'll mention it. This is unpublished work that is in the new booklet that comes with the new edition. This is unpublished.
Let me say this. Let me qualify that. It's published, Greg, but nobody. It's published, but it was published in 1947, 1948, and 1949 in three different sections, three different stories that actually fit together and make one novel. And it was in two different magazines. Two of them were in Amazing Stories, and one of them was that started off in Fantastic Adventures. So hardly anybody, even people who really think they know about the Shaver mystery, they don't have this. And as far as I know, it was never reprinted in Hidden World in Shaver's reprints that were done later on. They had after Shaver got kicked out. You know, this is another thing too. Shaver and Palmer were expelled from the science fiction community, and not only were they expelled from the science fiction community, but these precocious pseudo-intellectual fans that went after them, led by some left-wing science fiction writers in New York. And of course, they were coming out of the Shaver and Palmer were in Chicago, and that was, you know, they were good old boys, you know, in Chicago. And then you had the Trotskyites in New York, see, and they got the fans together, and then they pressured Ziff Davis, the publisher, to boot Shaver and Palmer out, but what I want to try to say here is that hardly anybody has this material. Now, Shaver and Palmer reprinted most of it in a set of books called The Hidden World, which Timothy Green Beckley has republished a bunch of them. I have a foreword or an introduction to number three, Hidden World. I mentioned that in the booklet. And that's one of Shaver's first novels, and I introduce it. However, I don't believe, now I may be wrong, but I don't believe that Ernest Cliff, which is the story I don't think anybody's reprinted that yet. So nobody, you know, people don't know. They don't realize that Shaver actually had a very, very good interdimensional theory going, and he had it a long time before wormholes and stargates and before the whole parallel world thing got to be really a viable concept. Shaver had this.
Well,
and it was
the thing is, he was well ahead of his time. I can figure at this point, I would say 75 years, easy. Because we just, you know, started realizing there is a whole string theory, multiverse, which I think is called M theory, which you have in the new booklet, talks about that. But it's like we didn't even think those thoughts. And as you say in the booklet, as part of the booklet, you say there back in the 40s, this was nothing more than a literary convention to create another place to go. I mean, that was about it.
Shaver didn't want people to think he was crazy. He was, but he didn't want people to think he was, and so he didn't want to have another dimension. Because at that time, unless you just said, okay, I'm writing fantasy, and you're talking about parallel worlds, and you say they're real, they're going to come after you with a butterfly net.
He was ahead of his time.
Now, however, we're faced with, I don't know whether you saw that documentary on the History Channel the other night on the MUFON's latest take on the UFO situation, but, Jacques Vallée, who's the primary researcher and scientist in the UFO category, has been saying for years and years and years, he was the one that was a model for Lacombe in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. He's been saying for years and years and years that flying saucers are coming from another dimension.
Didn't he write a book called Intercept But Do Not Destroy? Wasn't that one of his books, Jacques Vallée?
I don't know whether he wrote that one. He's he has a one called Other Dimensions. It's the one I'm referring to, and I know that his concept of the UFO, which is the most logical concept, and we know they're real. I mean, we've got loads. There's enough evidence. We know these things are real, but they're not. They're coming in and out of another dimension. You remember, you and I were playing with an idea about doing a TV series called Airship.
Yeah, I do remember that. Yes, I do. I remember that. Go ahead, folks.
Yeah. Well,
I remember. No, Airship was about people from another dimension before it was during, like, maybe the days of the Old West kind of thing, or even before that. But these airships would appear before there was any airships,
yeah.
Not balloons, nothing.
Yeah, 40 years before we had big Zeppelins, because big Zeppelins didn't come along until about 1913, and this was 1870s. These giant airships, not blimps, dirigibles, giant, you know, 800 foot long airships with 20 man crews, and obviously gas or diesel engines coming. And they were flying over American cities in the Midwest and taking the city council and the mayor for rides, and they were going over farms and putting down buckets to bring up groceries and paying the guys in Morgan dollars, and, you know, I mean, there's so much documentation on this that it.
Well, the thing is, folks, as I recall, I remember that conversation. I remember where we were. We were going to go see a film someplace in Orange County, call, and we sat down to have lunch, and I told you this idea, and then you shot back ideas, and we never got around to it, but it was very Jules Verne kind of a deal, you know, kind of, you know, Captain, the Conqueror of the World.
Yeah, one of these days we're going to do that thing. I think that will be that'll be a good one. But it's definitely a simultaneous kind of a thing. And I get kind of thinking that one of the reasons why the UFOs may be hanging around these reactors, besides sucking energy and these military bases where they have nuclear weapons, is because maybe the big nuclear explosions will actually contaminate different layers of the simultane. They may be concerned about that. And that would be a good explanation. Yeah.
You know, Pope, that's a very interesting thought, because maybe what each level of the shells of reality do affect the other shells. Now, see, nobody's said that yet. What they've said is, okay, well, you have your life here, but you have a parallel life over there, which is pretty much, you know, by decision, like you said in the booklet, you know, a parallel life over there, either by decision or by action. Right. But the thing, I never thought, you know, that's good. I never really thought about the fact that
The whole idea here of this, of these other dimensions, is that they are just as real as this one. And at the time that Palmer was trying to talk Shaver into some astral theory, Palmer was actually trying to talk Shaver into believing that his Darrows were ghosts that on the astral, in the stratosphere, and this was based on Palmer's being deep into this pseudo-Bible called a WASPI. And I don't blame Shaver at all. I would have rejected that completely. It had nothing whatsoever to do with what the visions he was receiving. And so I really sympathize with the way he, but let's don't forget now the rest of the film, the other side of the film, is based on another very, very interesting work, science fiction work, a classic called Dweller on Two Planets. That was the one that started off. That was the one that started off all this Mount Shasta Lemuria stuff. All got started
Philos, with Philos the Tibetan.
Philos, yeah. Tylos, the Atlantean, and we wanted to get, when we researched Mount Shasta and all of their mysticism up there, what we wanted to do was get back to the original source of all of it, the most important, the one that they all stem from, including the I Am and all the rest of them, and Telos and the whole business, going the whole psychic Lemurian Atlantean thing on Mount Shasta, all got started by a young fellow by the name of Frederick Spencer Oliver, who channeled. Mm-hmm. He channeled when he was out there on the slopes of Mount Shasta back in 18. I think it was about 1880 something, and he was a kid and just a teenager.
Right, right.
And he,
well,
he channeled
that out
this.
In the-
This Atlantean,
well, we bring
the
that out in
pilots.
The film, folks.
Yeah.
I mean, we do, and you're right. The other side of the film, dealing with Dweller in Two Worlds by Phylos the Tibetan, I believe. Yeah, that was the other side of it. That was the spiritual, that's the high side. That's the mountain slopes. That's the top of the mountain, as opposed to going down into the deep earth.
We did not want to have anything evil or anything dark up there on the top, on the side of the mountain, because that's beautiful. And that's a solar, Mount Shasta is a solar vision, and we went way, way up there, about as high as you can go and take, as high as you can drive a vehicle. And we were up there about 10,000 feet on that flat. And the mountains 14,000 feet.
Yeah, we were
up there as high as you can go up there where the spiritual work is done. And
we had the visionary stuff up
on the mountain right up there.
Right.
And had Dr. X, our scientist. Dr. Xavier was the good one. Dr. X was this evil counterpart with the Darrows, and he. He envisioned Brother Solomon as the fallen angel Semyaza from the Book of Enoch, and he's up there prophesying from the top of the mountain and holding up one of Shaver's like a rock book, like one of Shaver's whatever, and Phylos tells his story. And we had that beautiful little temple that we the miniature temple. You found the spot. You found the perfect spot for us to plant our little miniature temple and make it look like.
Right. So that it could appear. So it could appear in front of the cowboy that was going to find the truth. And that was an interesting dare.
Yeah, well, Phylos, that was right according to the book. Phylos was a mining engineer, and up there in Mount Shasta, right after the war between the states, he was trying to get away from the war, and he went up there and he met this Chinese this old Chinese fellow who was working with the mining crew, and turned out that this Chinese fellow was actually a wool master who really knew about this ancient temple up on Mount Shasta and told Phylos how to get there. And we found, I remember you did the casting on this one, you found this very, really, really wonderful Chinese gentleman to play the Wu Master in the film.
Yeah, he was perfect. He was perfect, I mean, in every way. Yeah. I mean, he doesn't really say anything. It's simply like a remembrance scene. But you see him sitting there at the talking to who will become, Phylos. You see him talking to him, and it worked so well, and it was shot right outside of your house. It was pretty good. I really enjoyed
that scene. Phylos, and of course, Mary Tamer did such a wonderful job playing Phylos on the one hand and then Abaddon, his evil counterpart, on the other hand. And Merrick, is a world-class, he's the best Masonic ritualist in California. He's like a Shakespearean actor. But he just did a beautiful job.
No, he is. You're absolutely right. Merrick was the joys of the set as far as, you know, as a, from a director's point of view. Merrick was one of the joys of the set because not only did he know his lines, like, he knew them, rather, you know, study. He already knew what he said. He actually was able to pull off the portrayal, and I didn't have to work too much with him. He was just, I didn't have to ask him for too much. It was simply, Merrick, are you ready to go? And he said, yes, I'm ready. And it's like, okay, action. And Merrick would just roll with it and make it work. Whatever it is you wrote, he was,
well, one
he
of
was
the
great.
About, one of the things about Beyond Lemuria that that makes it, really makes it a classic, is that we had genuine, honest-to-goodness, spiritual adepts, honestly magical and Western esoteric adepts playing the major roles. We had Lon Milo Duquette as Hermes Trismegistus,
yep,
on top of the mountain. And
he was great.
And that, you can't ask for any better than that. And then we had Paul Clark playing
Paul
Jesus,
Clark was
Master
great.
Jesus.
Absolutely great.
And
yep,
that was a performance. I think he was just as convincing as Jesus as the last one that they had that the Hollywood used. Yeah, he really was. I mean, you felt, you looked
no, we
at
had,
Paul
we
and,
had
and,
real and, we had real people, folks, that were,
yeah,
actually doing what they're talking about to a certain extent. I mean, not exactly, but in other words, everyone in that movie, almost everyone that was in that film, was someone that is either
you're
playing
now,
or,
close to the phone, Greg.
What's
Greg?
That?
Greg,
I'm
I can't
sorry.
Hear you.
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here,
oh,
but I couldn't hear you. You've got to keep your voice. You got to keep your voice right close to the phone.
Oh, I'm sorry. My fault. No, the thing is that everyone that was in the film, okay, really, everyone that was a principal player, there was a couple that weren't, but that really are what, you know, they what they said was what they truly believed.
Well, we shouldn't forget Ed Fitch, and he was supposed
oh,
to
no,
call
no,
him,
not at
said,
all. No
he
way.
Said he would. He said he would, but something must have come up that kept him from calling in. But Ed Fitch, of course, is world famous as Fitch the Witch. You know, I mean, he's one of the elders of witchcraft in this country. But he was also raised in a fundamental Christian environment, and so he was the perfect one to play the role, the dual role of, and of course also he was a colonel and I can say what service, but I mean he was a military, high ranking military officer in intelligence work, one thing or another. So he had a dual role where on the one hand he plays General Rich, I mean Colonel Rich, the agent for an agency so secret that we can't even name it, and we call it the company, of course. And then on the other side, he's Reverend Bobby John Rich, the fundamentalist Christian preacher. And he gets, you know, he goes up there on that mountain trying to save us, and we end up saving him. And that's another aspect of the, you know, he's really one of these bigoted Christian preachers who hates everybody, and we finally, you know, when Jesus finally appears to him and gives him the real message of love, we finally, you know, that's one of the high points of the film, I think. But Ed does such a good job playing both these roles, which both roles he's intimately familiar with. And, you know,
mm-hmm,
I've gotten a little bit of criticism for that. People say, well, what has this got to do, what is this fundamentalist preacher ranting and raving about all these things he hates, what has this got to do with what you guys are, you know, with our story of Atlantis and Lemuria and the Shaver mystery and all that? Well,
right.
My answer to that is that, as Pylos says in the film, too much. You can, if you're too fanatical on the side of the light, you can end up sending people into the darkness. Just because you think you're serving the light, that doesn't mean you can't do me wrong. And he was. So I think that
I think Lon said it best when he said, as Hermes, Trismegistus, when he said this, he said, sometimes when you seek the light, you find darkness. Sometimes through the darkness, you find the light. And I think that is kind of the crux of the movie right there, in a way.
Yeah. Well, I remember in the beginning, Lon is in the temple, and he says that very same thing. And beyond the light, you may find the darkness, or beyond the darkness,
right,
you may find the light. The choice must
right.
always be yours. And he turns over the hourglass, and the hourglass runs, and that whole 2 hours of questing and searching all takes place inside the temple while the sand is running in the hourglass. Because the candidate, William Morgan, is in the temple, and he's standing before the altar, and on the altar are
right.
two cups, and he knows he has to drink one of them. One of them is a dark cup.
The black
cup,
one and the white one.
And the black
That's
one
right.
and the white one. And he knows he has to make a choice.
Right.
And so Lon turns the Hermes over in the side, and the visionary kind of thing. He turns the hourglass over, and that whole next 2 hours of questing and searching and everything is while that sand runs. And we cut
so
in
really,
and out.
Well, what you're
and
saying, folks,
finally,
is,
finally,
and
when
and
the sand runs out, when the sand runs out, Morgan realizes that the Darrows are so evil that he picks up the white cup and drinks it, and that's that.
Right.
That sums it up. Yeah.
Well, really, the whole film is actually it takes place in really moments. All about his choices and his thinking about those choices and the future or another future. You know, it's really very mystical film, and I hope people get that that's what it's all about, really, because it's his choice to make one future or another.
Now, another point in that film where you gave a line, one of the key lines in the film, and that's just when Merrick in the role of Abaddon, the
right.
you know, the Grand Master of the Draconians, and he's down there,
right.
he's going through the vortex, he's down there in the Darrow caverns, in
right.
literally in hell, and
right.
and Lilith is about to be, you know, destroyed on the, you know, on the telug, and
yeah,
and you as Zoltan Odescu, and you take off
right.
your glasses, your sunglasses, and reveal
Ooh.
these inhuman white contacts, you know, with then you told Merrick. He's trying to bargain
let,
with you, and yeah, do you know that? You remember
work.
Those
let
lines?
Me, let me set the scene here, because I watched that scene several times, folks. What happened was, he said, "I'm the Grand Master. I'm the Grand Master for life," and then he said, "You need people on my side of the world of the multiverse," but. You know, and then I said, you know, we don't have to deal with any human beings. Remember that?
Yeah.
And then what I went on to say was, and you'll love this, and I'll do it as Zoltan Odescu. He said, You have read the Book of the Damned by Charles Fort. As you recall, after he had collected all the strange anomalies, his logic and his reason led him to only one conclusion, that the people of Earth were someone else's property. Now you know who your owners are. And then, of course, Chris goes ahead and kills him.
Well, yeah,
that
but, Merrick said, wait a minute, now, don't forget, though, then Merrick says, but that's only if we follow your path.
Oh, that's true.
And then you said, yes, but you found that out too late.
Too late. You found that out too late. No, you're right. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I didn't need that. That's crucial.
Yeah, that's one of the key things in the film, is that, yeah, if we follow your path, and yeah, and then you retort, yes, but you found that out too late.
Too late.
And yeah, this is really... Now, one more thing. I had one of our members asked me, why did you call the young candidate, why did you give him the name of William Morgan? Well, I gave him the name of William Morgan because William Morgan was the young captain way back in 1830 that betrayed Masonry and then disappeared.
Oh, right.
Nobody ever knew
what
happened to him.
No, I forgot about that.
I called it William Morgan, but there's more to it. Actually, around the time or shortly after Philo's, shortly after Dweller on Two Planets was printed, a fellow by the name of Yuri Lloyd, Russian first name and Welsh last name, Yuri Lloyd, came out with a book called Etadorfa, which is Aphrodite spelled backwards. And in that book, he had William Morgan disappearing into an underworld very much like Shavers.
You're teaching me as usual.
Yeah, I knew about it, I'm going to use this, and I'm going to check it. So a few people picked up on that, but that's why we call him William Morgan. And anyway, Beyond Lemuria is chock full of occult philosophy. It's got some very, very beautiful. Lon Duquette delivers at the end of the film. He delivers a dissertation on modern Hermetic philosophy that is worth the whole price of the film. And by the way,
yes,
for the second edition, yes, we cut the price in half. So now it's $9.95. So it's a bargain at twice the price.
everybody that's interested in this subject matter or wants to maybe find something in themselves really ought to take a look at Beyond Lemuria. It is visually gripping. It's hypnotic at times. And at other times, it's spiritually uplifting. And it really is. And that's what I would say about what we did.
Well, thank you for bringing that out. I didn't want to say it, because naturally I produced the darn thing, and I didn't want to come out and tell everybody how good it is. So I appreciate you doing it. But it is. But I will say this. If you really study this film and what is put forth in it, you will learn some very significant occult secrets and philosophy, because we have used ancient rituals.
Yes.
We've used the deepest aspects of Hermetic philosophy, and we've combined that with a modern interpretation of the Shaver mystery, and a look at the old classic Dweller on Two Planets. We've tied the whole thing together. Not only that, we went out to Nan Madol in the Pacific, and we have the best photographs of the ancient Lemurian ruins that anybody has done yet. And so
that was you and Mark Nelson. You guys did that. We just used the footage. I mean, I wasn't there
that's
for
right.
that.
Well, but it's
you guys.
That's the first time anybody's ever seen it. That footage, and so it's part of the film. And the only place you're going to get it is in Beyond Lemuria. And so I want to mention that. And so anyway, this about wraps us up. Now, next week we're going to have a show on a remarkable book, a review on a remarkable book that I strongly recommend everybody that's really interested, seriously interested in Hermetic magic and Hermetic philosophy should definitely have the book and definitely read it. And this is a book called The Hermetic Link. Joshua, or is it, I can never remember his first name. Jacob Slavenberg. That's J-A-C-O-B-S-L-A-V-E-N-P-U-R-G. It's called The Hermetic Link, From Secret Tradition to Modern Thought. And I'm about three quarters of the way through it, and I'm absolutely fascinated. And if I was more of a scholar and had access to all of the material he's got over there in Europe, I hope I could write something as good as this. It's really, really good. And so next week we will deal with The Hermetic Link. And until then, good magic.